Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you so much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. We kick off this particular Tuesday with yet another weird law from around the world. This one comes to you courtesy of Italy, in Rome to be more specific, in the Sistine Chapel. It is illegal to take photos or to film anything whilst in the chapel. Now, the origin of this law is particularly interesting. It was initially as a result of an agreement with a Japanese broadcaster that had funded the restoration of the chapel many years ago. Although that particular agreement has expired, those that are the custodians of the Sistine Chapel still enforce the ban, and you could be faced with a fine or a penalty if you are seen to be violating this particular law. Interestingly enough, you are allowed to take photos in the Vatican museums, just not in the Sistine Chapel. You're tuned into the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, and on the show today we're going to be taking a look at the South African Rand. At the moment, we're going to be taking a look at the performance of the Rand for the year, where we go to from here amidst all of the global tensions, and what lies ahead for the world's best performing emerging market currency. We're also going to take a look at a conversation with the National Consumer Commission around a warning that was put out to online shopping retailers, particularly foreign online shopping retailers, the likes of Shein and Temu. This warning was put out by the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition in the form of the Minister, Minister Park Stau, but also the National Consumer Commission has been keeping an eye out on some of the practices of these companies. We're going to get a sense of what is developing there and why the National Consumer Commission are keeping an eye out on these platforms. We also have a conversation with the team at MyBroadband, taking a look at the fact that South African systems, certain South African government sites, were offline for quite a bit of time from yesterday around 2 o'clock. We're going to take a look at what caused the incident and what has been done about it. Then we've also got a conversation with the team at MedShield around their product suite for 2026. And then we're going to wrap up the show with a property feature. We're going to be taking a look at estate levies and understanding them better.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Yes, this is the market update, and yes, we are going to get into markets in just a second. Before we get to those, I just wanted to let everybody know that South Africa is leading Rwanda 1-0, 6 minutes into the game. Bafana has scored, and we are hopefully going to maintain control of the game for the remainder of the game. Obviously, we'll run out of time for our show, so Michael Abramson will be able to give us a proper update around what happened with that game. But for now, let's get into markets. I'm joined on the line by the founder at Just One Lap and good friend Simon Brown to take a look at market movements throughout the day and see what we make of some of these movements. Si, lovely to have you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. The gold price almost touching $4,200 a fine ounce on the spot price. I imagine futures might have traded a little bit higher there, but seemingly momentum is just another word at this point. There's no stopping it.
Evening, Jimmy. Yes, speechless, isn't it? At this point in time, you're right. There is no stopping gold. This is now, and it's to be clear, only 2 days into the trading week. But this, we've had 8 green weeks in a row from gold, and if this week closes green, it'll be 9. And I can't find another time. I can find one other time we did 8. I can't find a time we did 9 green weeks. Gold has absolutely, after 4 months of trading in a sideways range, suddenly up, what, $700? I'm not sure I've ever seen it from gold.
Si, what does this then mean for the prospects of markets? I mean, at the moment, markets are weighing up a lot of tensions. Gold seems to be the flavor due to its safe haven appeal. And with everything that is happening, it seems safe havens are the order of the day. But do we have enough momentum to see 4,500, to see 5,000? I know you and I have looked at this and we didn't think we had enough momentum to even get to $4,000 an ounce. But it seems this is where we are now. This is our new reality.
Look, Jimmy, the simple answer is we will see $4,500 gold, we'll see $5,000 gold. I'll be so brave as to say maybe 10. The point is when. 10 is a long way away. $4,500, $5,000, it really could happen this year. I mean, it really could. I'm not saying it would, but I didn't think we'd be, you know, above 4,100 in October. That was not on my radar for this year. There were some predictions, Merrill Pick from Old Mutual Investment Group. I think it was Goldman Sachs were both saying sort of 4,500 by year end, and that's deeply possible. But it's a weird market. You talk around safe haven, and that's what gold is. But the risk on assets are also elevated. Crypto is off a bit, but it's still high. S&P, NASDAQ, I mean, they're down again this evening, but they're just off all-time highs. We're seeing American bonds being bought. It's a market that's both risk on and risk off, and I think that's a fundamental shift that's happening to a degree in terms of some people don't want to buy dollars anymore, and absent of that, they're largely buying gold.
As the popular kids would say, this wasn't on the bingo card for 2025. Si, let's look at international markets. The Nasdaq down about 1% at the moment. The Nikkei down about 2.5%, obviously being closed yesterday for the public holiday, but coming back to a weaker market in general. International indices at the moment are also feeling a bit of the pressure. But again, contextually, for the year, markets have done well.
They've done spectacularly well. I mean, it has been a more than ridiculous return so far for the year. I mean, the Nasdaq up 17%, the S&P up 12.9% as we speak. That's year to date. And let's be clear, those are better than long term averages, but by a healthy amount. The S&P long term average is probably closer to 8-ish, and while the Nasdaq it always has wild numbers. But I mean, our market is up over 30%. But it has been a very strong year, and it is. There's been, if we look at offshore markets in the US, it's really been all around the AI. If we look at Europe, it's been mostly around defense, and to a degree, a bit of power. South Africa, it's been a gold and PGM rally. It's been very specific and narrow in each market, but the runs have been absolutely spectacular.
So I want to move to the oil market quickly. The oil price dipping below $62 a barrel. Basically, the last time I see that we were here recently, or the most recent time I see us dipping below $62 a barrel, was back in May of this year. We kind of bottomed out early in May, around that $58 a barrel level, but that number very much in contention at this point. Nice to see a bit of reprieve on the oil price side of things, but we know that from an OPEC bloc perspective, they're not too comfortable with the oil price sitting on the lower end of their target range.
They're not, but Saudi Arabia is, and Saudi Arabia is trying to be best mates with President Trump, and he wants a low oil price. So they, I mean, OPEC Plus has been doing production increases for much of this year in the face of a declining oil price, as you say. I mean, very much at the bottom end of where they want to ultimately have an oil price. They would like it around 90 or 100, I imagine. But also just flooding the market with it, keeping that price lower. And Saudi Arabia's got the capacity to do it. They also want to. There's always an OPEC and OPEC Plus. There's some states which pump more than they're allocated. They cheat in theory, and this is one way of punishing them by pushing prices lower. And I mean, oil looks weak. It you know, from peaks in what mid 24 at around the 90, it's pretty much been going downwards, and looks like it's probably heading lower.
Si, that clearly is a good thing for fuel prices. I mean, I'm looking at, as you said, heading lower seems to be, if we can break that 58 or 55 odd dollar a barrel level, we could very realistically see $40 a barrel. But that, I would imagine, would take quite a bit of doing, because the markets would not be happy with that figure. If we look at some of the other commodity prices, I mean, commodities have been driving a lot of market movements. Platinum almost $1,700 a fine ounce, palladium almost $1,600 at this point, even silver finding a bit of favor within the markets and within central banks. Somehow, amidst all of the uncertainty, amidst all of the tension, it is a good time to be a commodity trader, or even a company that deals in commodities, as our resource counters are?
Yeah, absolutely. The commodities are booming, and yeah, there's so many others that we can throw into that mix. We can throw copper into it, even aluminium prices. I mean, there is at this point a really good driver of the more precious, the industrial, the bulk commodities, iron ore, coal. They're still struggling. They're not doing as great. And what it is it's a reshoring of global trade under the Trump presidency. And if he's threatening tariffs left, right, and center, markets need to root around that. The US sort of becomes a problem, and they need to root around. They also want to secure supply and the like. And I think that's what we're seeing, which is pushing, because certainly what we're not experiencing is robust growth. To be clear, there's growth coming out of the US. A lot of it is AI driven. But if you look at the forecasts out for next year and into 27, they are typically lower than expectations for 2025. So this is happening, I think, in a shift. And there's also the process. Copper mines quickly, like Chile, you used to be able to get a mine up and running in 18 months. Now it takes 5 to 6 years. There's a lot more red tape, so not much new green developments.
Speaking of copper, Simon, before I let you go, I can't let you go without looking at this that seems to have just made its way onto the bingo card for the year. Harmony Gold pushing ahead with that MAC Copper acquisition in Australia, around a $1.03 billion valuation at around $12 per share. They're looking to completely acquire that mine, and that puts them squarely in the copper space. And exactly to your point that you just made, Si, it's no green projects. It's an existing mine, existing output, existing operations, but diversifies Harmony.
It does, and Jimmy, I can't work out where I sit with it. Harmony used to be a pure gold play, like Goldfields, AngloGold Ashanti, DRD, and these are the locally listed mines. Of course, there's offshore as well, and they were pure gold plays, and you knew what you got on the sticker. Gold price boomed, the miner boomed significantly more. Now you're going to copper, and we've got a similar situation in a sense in Sibanye with PGMs and gold. Now there's the two commodities there, and at the moment the gold move makes all miners rich, doesn't matter what else you mine. But at certain points, do they work against each other? I'm not sure. I generally a fan of the single commodity miner. That does mean that you've got to get your timing right. But the truth is, copper's the new gold. There's no AI and electric stuff, etc., without a lot of copper.
Copper might just be the new gold, and perhaps miners are seeing that and getting in whilst they still can. We'll keep an eye on that, but for now we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Si for those insights and for this time. Simon Brown, founder at Just One Lap, joining us to take a look at market movements and perhaps some of the key market sectors.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't, because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
With all that's happening around the world, I thought we'd take a look at the South African Rand, the best performing emerging market currency in the world at the moment. We're going to see if it still is the best performing and how it could potentially close out the year. I'm joined on the line by senior economist at PwC, Dr. Christy Fullion, to take a look at this and some of the factors behind it. Christy, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Less than a week ago, about Thursday of last week, we were talking about 17 rand and 6 cents to the US dollar. Just today, we were flirting with 17 rand 50 to the US dollar. Clearly, a very volatile time. Markets might consider 40 cents move on the rand fairly normal for the rand, but it is evident of the fact that there are a lot of factors that are up for consideration here. How are you reading the performance of the rand for the year?
Well, volatility is basically what the rand is. I mean, if you look at a definition of the rand in the dictionary, it'll probably tell you it's one of the most volatile currencies there is. But it's basically because it's so traded, you know, it's so easy to trade. It's in the top 10 most traded currencies. So by that implication alone, we're going to see lots of movement. But as you said, a lot is happening. And the rand gets thrown this way and that way whenever there's things happening globally and locally, whether it's politics or economics or conflict. So we just need to open any news website, any news app to see that there's so much going on in the world at the moment that's not only impacting the rand and other emerging market currencies, but also impacting strong big currencies like the US dollar, which is usually more stable, but it's actually experiencing more volatility at the moment. So I don't want to say it's a perfect storm, because then that's a negative. And close to 17 to the dollar quite a few times of late, which as a consumer or anyone that's importing something into South Africa, that's good news. It means that import is actually cheaper than before.
Christy, let's take a look at some of those global macro factors that seem to be playing out that are affecting the likes of the rand. I mean, we saw just this weekend renewed trade tensions between the United States and China. We know that we were expecting the world leaders of both nations to meet up later this year in South Korea. We don't know whether that's still on the cards, but clearly the market sentiment around the developments out of Washington, the developments out of Beijing, being factored into the overall risk sentiment in the market. But more than that, it starts to filter into things like emerging markets, because that's where a lot more of the risk seems to be sitting at the moment.
Most certainly. Look, the tariff story is the story of 2025. Yes, it's coming out of Washington, but because there are so many countries reacting to it, and China as well, the second largest economy in the world, whenever there's trade tension between those two countries, which inherently is a bit of political tension as well, emerging markets take a bit of a knock, take a bit of a back seat. So you'd expect that to be negative for the rand. And that's probably why, one of the reasons why we've moved away from that 17 level back towards 1750. Of course, the rhetoric coming from the US changes one day to the next day. And, you know, it could change from one tweet to the next, or one social media post. And what we're seeing is this uncertainty and this volatility. Will there be a meeting between the two presidents? Will there not be a meeting? They don't even have to meet, let's be honest. There can be lots of developments, like suddenly an extra 10 or 50 or 100% tariff. We know that this week we've seen increased costs added at harbors and ports at both countries as part of this process. So the big world story of 2025, it's tariffs. We're now deep into October. It's still tariffs. It's going to be tariffs for quite a long time. And the rand will ebb and flow as these tariffs move. Even if it doesn't specifically involve South Africa's tariffs and the US relationship, when the global markets react to tariffs, it's South Africa is going to follow.
Now, Christy, the likes of Goldman Sachs and other big asset managers and banks around the world have said that the recent rallies that we're seeing, emerging market currencies would be doing well in times where they're able to offer a better return than, for example, the US dollar. Do we see the rand before the end of the year punching below 17 rand, or possibly even closing the year below 17 rand? And if that is something we would like to see, what needs to happen to move that needle?
I think below 17 is very, very possible. Whether it's next week or next month, I'm quite sure it's going to happen. Whether it's going to close below 17, that's going to be up to all kinds of politics, and mostly the politics outside of our control. But so many factors supporting the rand is still heading in the right direction. We're looking at record high gold prices, for example. We're looking at our interest rates, which are, let's call, relatively unchanged in terms of the next, the short-term view. And in the US, it's probably down. So that interest rate differential always supports a currency. If we think of what our stock market is doing, which is doing very well, there's been a significant net foreign investment inflows into the JSE, which is supportive of the rand. So there's so many, I want to say, rand fundamentals that are pointing in the right direction, that moving below of when, not if, and that when could really be very soon.
That when could be around the corner. It might not necessarily happen today. It might not necessarily happen tomorrow, but it is certainly on the cards, and that's what we love to hear. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Dr. Christy Viljoen, Senior Economist at PwC, for joining us to take a look at the rand's performance for the year so far and how we could potentially close out the rest of the year.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
In a world where a lot can change in 6 years, you can rest assured that Hino's 6-year drivetrain warranty won't. All Hino trucks now come standard with a 6-year drivetrain warranty, protecting your investment all the way from pistons to gears. Built to keep your business moving, supporting uptime, growth, and daily operations. Because although a lot can change in 6 years, our warranty promise won't. Terms and conditions apply. Hino all the way.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
If in the last 24 hours you logged on to a government website and found that the website was down and you wondered why, perhaps we have an answer for that. It seems as though there were some technical difficulties with one of the main domains that runs our government websites. We're going to be taking a look at this with the editor at My Broadband, Jan Vermeulen, and he joins me on the line now to see what we make of these developments. Jan, lovely to have you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. So what happened here? What's going on?
Yeah, so in short, there was a cable break that caused an outage on the main gov.za domain name system server, DNS. And that caused a widespread outage across the infrastructure that allows us to access these sites in the first place. This is run by CETA. So all the infrastructure run through CETA systems went offline. The government systems that run, that are cloud-based, did not have this problem. So SARS was working, and the Department of Justice and a handful of other government departments, their websites and other services were still online. But the stuff that runs through CETA was all broken. And really, what happened here that was a little distressing is the primary fiber that serves a data center here in Centurion was cut. So there was a fiber break that happened. And then the secondary fallback failed. And we've not received confirmation about what caused that failure yet. But so they had a fallback connection, and that failed as well. And then on top of that, we discover that CETA runs the primary and secondary DNS for gov.za out of the same facility. And so that should really just not happen. And so none of the redundancies that are supposed to have been in place worked, which is why we had this widespread outage across gov.za domains.
Now, Jan, in the digital age that we live in, with all of the cyber attacks we've seen of late and all of the outages we've seen, what do we make of this particular outage? Many people might wonder whether or not this then exposes the .gov.za domains and leaves us vulnerable to future cyber attacks, or if this is just an isolated incident unrelated to anything else. Are there insights that can potentially lead us to identifying what caused these? Has CETA commented on this?
So CETA hasn't provided confirmation about what caused the primary cable break or what caused the secondary to fail. So we have no answers there. And certainly it does point to problems with our critical government internet infrastructure, in the sense that this was a single point of failure. And so, as you say, as we move into a more digital age, and perhaps as South Africa makes more enemies around the world who might want to know how best to attack us, this kind of thing exposes exactly how vulnerable our infrastructure can be, and how easy it can be to attack and take offline. And so that is something that really needs to be paid attention to ensure that, you know, if a malicious actor were to ever, you know, try to target South Africa, that they're not going to have an easy go of it, that at least we have, you know, basic redundancies and basic defenses in place.
Now, Jan, this outage specifically relates to domains. Doesn't necessarily mean that it translates into other systems being offline, because the understanding is that government departments still maintain their own operational systems. And so while, for example, a website might be down, it doesn't necessarily mean that internal systems for that respective department might be down. Is this the case in terms of kind of the separation of how these functions and softwares are managed?
Sometimes. So, unfortunately, I mean, for security reasons, we don't know the intimate details of of how the government network is configured. But certainly any government department that was impacted by the outage yesterday will, if they were using that .their.gov.za domain for anything else, right? So whether that's a mobile app or an email, that would not, that there's a good chance that that would not have worked either, because those all rely on DNS. So to perhaps explain what DNS does, and the way to think about DNS is it's like an old telephone book, or maybe the way to think about it nowadays is Truecaller, right? So you type a phone number in to the database, or you submit a phone number to the database, and or it's rather a translation mechanism between the name of something and the number, the phone number, or in this case, the IP address, which is a numeric address where you can reach that server. So, you know, for us, we might go to www.gov.za, but behind the scenes, what your browser is doing is contacting a DNS server and having that translated into a numeric address of how to communicate with that domain. And email works in the same way. If you were emailing our illustrious president yesterday at his .gov.za email address, then if the DNS for the presidency was offline, then the email address would also not necessarily have resolved. So if DNS breaks, a lot of things, it causes a cascading failure. A lot of things break along the way.
Now, thankfully, this has been resolved, at least according to CETA. They've worked overnight to get the systems back online. Jan, from a security perspective, do South Africans have anything to be worried about here?
Not that we know that anything in particular was stolen or something like something happened during this outage. But this outage certainly points to much larger failures within the government's IT infrastructure that really needs to be looked at, or we will have a problem.
Rather looking at it now and fixing it now before it results in a bigger problem, hopefully that is the focus here. But we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Jan for those insights and for the time. Always lovely having you on the show. Jan Vermeulen, editor at My Broadband, on the government's domain name system servers going offline briefly yesterday and what might have caused them.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Today is a market and a sport update in part because it is now 2-0 between South Africa and Rwanda. That 5-minute goal from Talet Mbata was followed on by a 26th-minute goal from Oswin Apollis. That's all I'm going to say on it because Michael Abramson is going to come up a little later on to give you a better in-depth analysis of the game. We're going to take a look at the latest developments from the National Consumer Commission alongside the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition that are keeping a close eye on international platforms like Shein and Temu following some recent updates on the part of one of these platforms that they now have local warehousing facilities and a bit of miscommunication that came through from there. I'm joined on the line by the spokesperson at the National Consumer Commission, that is Petron Taba, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Petron, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. What is the National Consumer Commission concerned about here?
Like any other practice or business in the Republic of South Africa, Jimmy, online stores, e-commerce retailers must ensure that they comply with the provisions of the Consumer Protection Act and other regulation or policy in the Republic of South Africa. So we have been monitoring what consumers are saying. Obviously, they are saying this on platforms like social media and the likes, you know, where they complain about either the quality, either the issue of the competition and how to retain some of these goods. You know, when they receive something, they buy this, they receive something else. We have not received formal complaints from the consumers. We are just monitoring the space. And that's why internally we have decided that we are going to focus on e-commerce in South Africa in general, do some internal scoping that is going to tell us which route to take rather, to ensure that we protect South African consumers.
I was just saying before we got cut off that part of the concerns from a National Consumer Commission perspective is the advertising of things like a local warehouse. I remember distinctly that Temu did this online on social platforms. They've since come out to clarify that these are not their warehouses but operated by third parties, which is not the impression that we were given when they were initially announced. Can you take us perhaps through what are your concerns around this and around the information that is being shared with consumers?
The CPA is very clear, Jimmy, that consumers need to know who they are transacting with, where is that particular service provider, the contact details, the name, the text number, and the likes. This assists the consumer if they need to return the products. If a supplier has footprint in the Republic of South Africa, they need to provide that information. Either you can return the goods using the other services like your courier companies, or you can return them directly to our store. Now, they also need, by the law, by the Consumer Protection Act, they need to also declare if they are intermediaries. We need to know that information. It needs to be provided to the consumers upfront. So these are some of the issues, though I don't really want to go into detail as to exactly what is it that you are looking at, but we're looking at practices of e-commerce or online stores versus the provisions of the Consumer Protection Act. We are not targeting the one or two suppliers that you might have mentioned, but we're looking at e-commerce holistically and to say they need to ensure that their practices or how they conduct their businesses is in compliance with the CPA, and of course, it's fair trading in as far as the Republic of South African laws are concerned.
Now, understandably, this could potentially result in a much larger investigation, as you rightly alluded to here, Petro. Before I let you go, I want to get a sense, perhaps this might slightly fall outside of the National Consumer Commission's remit, but the other concern here, of course, does then become that if we don't address this, the likes of the South African Revenue Services will continue to suffer some losses from a tax perspective because of the import loopholes that some companies may be taking advantage of here. Now, that is a SARS conversation, and they will have that investigation on their part. But from a legislative perspective and from a South African perspective, protecting consumers in line with the CPA goes beyond just what it is that they're buying, but it goes to all of the laws of the country, as you mentioned at the start of our conversation.
Correct. They have to comply with all the laws of the Republic of South Africa. Goods that are coming into the Republic of South Africa, Jimmy, they must comply with the laws, starting from the imports, starting from the port of entry. If goods do not comply there, as the National Consumer Commission, of course, working with SARS, we do block those goods. Then we say, take them back to the country of origin or destroy those goods. So starting there, goods must comply. Coming into the Republic of South Africa, they must comply. There are issues of quality as well. There are issues of toys that kids, that parents buy for their kids. Those goods must comply with the provisions of the CPA and other laws of the Republic of South Africa. Hence, we're saying we're looking at e-commerce holistically. And one might also remember that when you look at e-commerce, there are some limitations in as far as, consumers having to return those goods. Someone might just buy and say, I'm not going to, look, it's anyway, I bought it, at whatever rent. I'm not going to take it back. It shouldn't be like that. When you buy something online, you should be able to receive what you have bought. If it's not what you have bought, you have the right to take it back. But also, we need to look at our law as well as the National Consumer Commission working with the DTIC to say, if there are limitations, how do we then ensure that we bring reform, we change our laws here and there to accommodate some of these nuances that consumers might be facing on a daily basis.
Everything is done in an effort to protect consumers, even from e-commerce platforms. We're going to keep an eye on this and see how this potential investigation will then unfold. For now, as the spokesperson of the National Consumer Commission, Petro Ntaba, just alluded to, it is keeping an eye out on service providers and making sure that the service providers adhere to South African laws.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This interview is brought to you in proud partnership with MedShield Medical Scheme, your trusted healthcare partner for life. Visit medshield.co.za for more information. MedShield Medical Scheme recently announced their 2026 product suite. They aim to offer more value to their members and to ensure that their members are better taken care of. To take a look at this, I'm joined on the line by the Principal Officer at MedShield, Kevin Aaron. Kevin, thank you so much for taking the time. Lovely to have you on the show. Let's start with the changes that you've made. What are you looking to offer members in 2026? How are you approaching the year differently?
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for the time and welcome to all your listeners. Yeah, for 2026, I think we've put a great product into the market. Effectively, I think the most important thing which people are the most concerned around is affordability. And I think in that respect, you know, MedShield has really been very competitive. If you look at it, 72% of our members will enjoy no more than a 7% increase, which I think in medical aid terms is really good. And if you look at the market, you know, typically medical aids aren't able to come close to inflation. So, you know, the 7% increase for 72% of our members is really, really, really good from an affordability perspective. So that's probably, you know, one of the biggest highlights. And also what we've done is we've increased benefits. So across all our options, you know, the scheme is in such good financial health that we've actually got the luxury of being able to look at how we increase benefits for the members. I think that's what people are wanting.
Kevin, knowing that this is what the consumers want and what your members want, what have you done specifically from a benefits and an offering perspective to meet that consumer need?
So we've increased day-to-day benefits across all our options. We've reduced co-payments, and we've also looked at a number of interesting things in terms of preventative care. So typically most medical schemes, for example, fund mammograms for women over a 24-month cycle. We've actually reduced that to a 12-month cycle. So MedShield will fund a mammogram out of risk every 12 months for females over the age of 30. And that's really because, you know, it's a great preventative care benefit. Women who have mammograms often can pick up early stage breast cancer. We've also done that for things like eye tests. You know, most medical schemes have a 24-month cycle where they fund an eye test every 24 months. You know, we have a view that people's eyes deteriorate more rapidly than 24 months, and that obviously causes distress for members when they can't get an eye test funded out of the scheme. So we've reduced the age or the cycle to 12 months. So every 12 months, members of MedShield will be able to get a free eye test. We've also looked at a technology, health technology. So one of the things that we're really excited about is for children up to the age of 18 who have type 1 diabetes. Typically, they have to finger prick themselves 5-6 times a day to check their glucose readings. You know, for 2026, MedShield will fund a continuous glucose monitoring wearable sensor for children up to the age of 18. And that sensor, it's non-invasive. It connects to an app and it gives them a continuous glucose reading. And then I think, you know, I could go through so many, but I think the other one that's really exciting is on all our options, we've increased the number of virtual consultations that the scheme will pay for. So this is something that members don't have to fund themselves. If you need a virtual consultation, whether it's telephonic, WhatsApp, via Teams or Zoom, across any speciality, the scheme will fund 5 virtual consultations and they'll fund that out of risk. On the majority of options. So I think we've put a very nice package together.
Kevin, in the saturated medical schemes market, competitiveness is essential for survival. How are you gearing up the business to be competitive in the market that you operate in?
What we've also done is we've significantly enhanced our top of the range option, our premium plus option. We call it going from 95 to 105. And that's really our focus, which is to be a much more dominant player in the corporate market. We think we've got the best value for money options available, but we felt that we needed to enhance our top of the range option, something that executives might want extra cover and you can afford it. So we've made a significant number of benefit improvements to Premium Plus, and we've also cut all the co-payments to make it far more competitive in the market. So I think that's really, you know, some of the key things, the main things we've done, obviously keeping the contribution increases as low as possible. And then we were very excited just before we launched our 2026 product to find out from Global Credit Ratings that they had improved our rating from a AA minus to a AA. And I think this confirms, again, the very strong financial position that MedShield finds itself in. We've probably got the highest solvency of all open schemes in the market. So, you know, we're very excited for 2026, and we think we are presenting to our members and potential members a beautiful suite of products that really reflects MedShield's philosophy, which is partner for life and offering real value for money.
Kevin, you touched on contributions and the increase to those contributions. How do you balance affordability from a member perspective whilst still bearing in mind that MedShield remains a business, and so financial performance and long-term sustainability are still important for you? How do you balance those two factors?
Yes, thanks. And in fact, the increase is largely closer to 7%. But you're right, it is a balancing act. But and you have to juggle many things, such as increased utilization, the demographic profile of your member, the cost of technology, the cost of healthcare, the tariffs which you negotiate with service providers, especially hospitals. But I think, you know, we've been very fortunate in that we've managed it very conservatively and very well. Our clinical risk has been very good in terms of achieving good outcomes. And we've actually financially found ourselves in a very strong position. You know, last year we actually made a surplus in the scheme. We've seen increased membership, and that's afforded us the opportunity to obviously be quite prudent. I mean, you don't want to be, you know, irresponsible, because then, you know, the following year you could potentially go with very high contribution increases. But I think, you know, again, the strong solvency that we have in MedShield, which is just under 60%, has afforded us the luxury or the opportunity in terms of being able to give back more to our members, and at the same time managing the contribution increase to a level which we think is sustainable.
Giving back and giving more to members is the goal for the team at MedShield as they roll out their 2026 product suite. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Kevin Aaron, the principal officer at MedShield, for joining us to get a sense of where the business is headed going into the new year and what they're looking to offer their members. This interview was brought to you by MedShield Medical Scheme. For better healthcare today and tomorrow, choose MedShield Medical Scheme, your trusted healthcare partner for life. Join today. Visit medshield.co.za.
Life's filled with big dreams and little moments, from everyday laughter to major milestones. Each one matters, and your health shapes them all. Whether you're navigating career heights, building a family, or enjoying newfound freedom, MedShield Medical Scheme has a solution tailored for every chapter of your life. With MedShield, we're not just here for now. We're your medical aid partner for life, committed to supporting you every step of the way. Let's connect and secure your health together. Contact us today to plan your healthcare future at medshield.co.za.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Property Tuesday, and we're taking a look at something that is increasingly affecting more and more property owners, and in some cases, those that are renting properties as well. And that is the concept of levies, particularly levies when living in an estate. I'm joined on the line by the managing director at Trafalgar, that's Andrew Schaefer, to take a look at this and see what you make of it. Andrew, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with an understanding of levies. What are they meant to cover, and how are they meant to be administered?
Thanks for having me. So levies cover expenses for the community scheme. They typically are laid out at the annual general meeting in the budget. The budget gives all the expense line items that are covered by the levy, and they are approved by an ordinary resolution at a general meeting and are then enforceable from that point. The managing agent does need to advise the owners in writing, you know, after the AGM on what the levies are going to be.
Now, Andrew, when you say at the meetings, you're referring to the meetings that are then held by the homeowners associations, the body corporates, the respective governing bodies of the various estates. Is that correct?
That's correct. So all of these community schemes, they are required to have an annual general meeting every year. The challenge we see in the industry is that there's an amazing apathy that, you know, those meetings are very poorly attended. You know, very often there's no quorum and they have to be carried over to a following week, etc. So, you know, the difficulty is that many owners don't attend these meetings. They're therefore not aware of the budget, what the levies contribute to of approving the budget. And so the actual levies themselves are very unclear, you know, to many owners for those reasons. So we continuously try and promote why to attend the annual general meetings, why that's important, what information is covered there. But it just seems to be a trend that, you know, owners don't make the time, they're not interested, they don't attend.
Now, Andrew, when we're dealing with estates and sectional title schemes, the levy conversation around that, as you said, is held at the annual general meetings. But what do homeowners need to know about potentially some of the things that shouldn't be included in levies? If I happen to be attending one of these AGMs and I'm questioning whether or not this expenditure qualifies to be included in the levies to be shared amongst all of us, what do I need to know here?
So, you know, fines obviously shouldn't be part of levies. You know, those would be conduct rule, you know, infringements or related fines, you know, those would be outside of the levy budget. You know, I think it's important for owners just to, you know, be aware, are the levies, are the expenses market related? Are they correct? Does it cover what they see on the ground in the estate? Is it cost effective expenditure? Because, you know, everyone's interested in knowing their money's well spent. It's carefully, you know, monitored, and there's prudent financial management involved, and that will keep levies contained and avoid wastage. So it's really important that, you know, that's visible to the owners, that they buy into it. It will obviously lead to better payments. You know, the challenge in many estates is that there are those that don't pay the levies. You know, they fall into arrears, that affects the cash flow, and continuing service delivery at an estate, you know, security, cleaning, gardening, maintenance, all those sort of things rely on levies and cash flow to pay for them, to make sure that owners can benefit from those amenities.
Andrew, what about the surprise levies? We've agreed levies at the start of the year. This is what the levy is going to be for the new financial year. Halfway through the year, we get a message from the homeowners association or from the body corporate saying, hey guys, we need a special levy for this particular thing. How does that then get dealt with by the homeowners? Is it necessary to call another meeting? Is that voted on? How does that all work?
So in sectional title, the trustees are authorized to approve a special levy. But, you know, in our experience, you know, practically it's good practice to keep the owners informed. You know, if it's a big project, call a meeting, explain the scope of work, the quotes, the tendering process, selecting the service provider, the timetable, what it will mean on the ground. You know, that just promotes buy-in, better understanding, comfort levels amongst the owners. You know, there's obviously logistics the residents need to be aware of, and that just promotes better payment, you know, of the special levies. If owners are caught by surprise and the special levy seems onerous, seems short planned and, you know, just urgent or not well thought through, you know, owners become resistant. They therefore don't pay and they object and they make a fuss, and occasionally they can even vote out the trustees because they haven't found the process suitably followed. So, you know, the law says that the trustees can decide and implement it and follow it through. But, you know, I do think that effective communication, thorough consultation, promoting buy-in in that way makes a difference in terms of the overall project.
Andrew, what can homeowners do in the event that they don't receive communication from the association or from the body corporate or from their elected trustees and their representatives? What remedies do homeowners have in that situation where they might want to have a bit more color and transparency around what's happening, but there seems to be no communication from the trustees' perspective, as an example?
Yeah, I would suggest they reach out to the managing agent portfolio management, refer their questions in writing, ask for a written response. They could also ask, you know, set up a meeting, online meeting or in-person meeting to discuss and collect that information. They could ask to attend a trustee meeting, a director's meeting if necessary, just to you know, be on site with the decision makers to get that information and ask their questions. And really, that should be the first point of call. You know, it's possible they might have missed communication, or, you know, a lot of people are busy and they tend to leave these personal matters, home-related matters, to after hours, and sometimes that can be missed in the volume. So that should be first step. You know, if they are finding, you know, that the answers aren't forthcoming, you know, then there's an escalated approach, which ultimately could lead to a CSOS dispute, where they would lodge a particular, you know, dispute query because they feel internal remedies have failed to collect the information they want, or if they feel the decision-making around that was not correct.
Andrew, do these levies work the same in layered estates? What are those, and how does that differ from a regular estate?
So, I mean, it can get a little bit complicated because the configuration of these layered estates does differ. But, you know, in general, it could mean that somebody in a layered estate is paying more than one levy. They could be paying a levy to their own body corporate, and they could be paying a second levy to the master association around their community scheme, around their body corporate. So, you know, when they're paying more than one levy, then it becomes a bit more complicated. You know, what does each levy cover? How is that levy broken down? Who decides on that levy? And it's really important they budget for it so that they're aware the cost is coming and that they've factored it into their payments. Because the worst thing is that, you know, they fall into arrears, then there's interest and debt collection charges can accumulate very quickly, and it becomes a very unfortunate dispute. So that's why transparency is really important, you know, awareness from the outset, budgeting and planning, you know, from that sort of point of view. You know, every owner is entitled to attend an annual general meeting, which is where I say the budget is tabled and approved, and therefore the levy schedule is approved and you know, available at the annual general meeting. And, you know, if owners participate in that process and they, you know, aware of the details and buy into the whole process, it does make it much more, you know, much better, you know, for them to commit to those payments and to keep their levy accounts up to date. And like I said, ultimately, that is the cash flow which, you know, pays for these body corporates to operate and continue services to all the residents.
It's important to have a detailed understanding of your rights and obligations as a homeowner, but it's even more important to attend the meetings and be in touch with your homeowners association, your body corporate, your board of trustees, and all those responsible for administering your hard-earned levies. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Andrew for those insights and for the time. Andrew Schaefer, the CEO at Trafalgar Property Group, joining us to take a look at better understanding levies within estates.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That's the show for today, folks. If you've missed any of the conversations, you can catch up with them online. A final sporting update from my side. We are halftime into that game and we are still leading 2-0. We are also technically at the moment topping the group on goal difference and points. We will see how the second half unfolds, because the next sporting update you'll get will be from the top sports team, of course. They are going to be joining us just after the 7 p.m. news. As I said, if you've missed any of our conversations, we'll be keeping an eye out on some of the developments happening out of Washington and Beijing as we continue to evaluate these uncertain trade tensions. But for the time being, markets seem to be making the most of the trade. And as I say that, it is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Host is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news. He'll be followed, of course, as I mentioned, by the top sport team. So from my side, good night.